Hello, hello, and welcome back to Seeking Sustainability. If you are familiar with the podcast or follow the Instagram, which is, should I change the handle? It's at @SeekingSustainability_podcast. I know that's a very long URL, but I don't know. Maybe I should change it. But if you follow the podcast, then welcome back. It's been a while. And if you're new and this is your first episode that you've listened to, or you just recently found the podcast, then thanks for stumbling across it, however that may have happened. If you're listening to this, thank you. And you can follow the Instagram, like I mentioned, @SeekingSustainability_podcast. It's so long. But yeah, I'm glad you stumbled across this podcast, and thank you so much for listening and tuning in. And So full disclosure, if you don't want to listen to the introduction, sometimes I don't even listen to introductions, let alone my own, you can skip ahead to the interview with Pete Huff, who was so lovely. But I am going to talk a little bit about who knows what. So I debated whether or not to dive, not deep into my personal life, but I don't know, to talk about this in my absence from doing my podcast, or my lack of doing my podcast. I debated whether or not to talk about it because, you know, it is my podcast. You know, I host it. It's a personal extension of me in some way. So therefore, getting personal is inevitable. Plus, I'm a pretty open book and pretty talkative, even if it's to an inanimate object like a microphone. But I do get pretty personal. But I think, and I could be mistaken, but only to a certain extent. Like, there's only so much I've talked about. And honestly, I haven't had the desire lately to like talk to anyone / my microphone and divulge any information about my life, really. But I don't know. I felt kind of like maybe it would be a good challenge to myself, to be honest and open. And maybe someone who stumbles across this will resonate or connect, or I don't know, and not feel so alone if they're going through something weird too. So again, you can skip ahead or you know, stay with me through this. But if you follow the podcast, then you may or may not have noticed that I haven't posted an episode in several months. And there typically is a gap of time between when I record an episode and when I edit it. But this one was recorded several months ago. So thank you to Pete and any of his coworkers, or anyone who is from the Pasture Project, for being so patient. But I debated whether or not to talk about this, but the last few months have been incredibly difficult for me. Some of the hardest that I've been through mentally, emotionally, financially. And, you know, I'm young, I'm in my early 20s, which is, I feel like, a tumultuous time for anyone. And it's definitely a time where I feel like a lot of us are trying to figure out what the heck we're doing and who we are and our why and our what and our how, and whether that's how we're going to pay our bills or how we're going to advance our career or what we want to do or why we want to do certain things. But that's what I've been going through. But anyways, yeah, the last few months, I'm not going to give any specifics really, but have been really, really hard. So honestly, I lost my interest in everything. And that was really difficult because, and I've always struggled with ups and downs. That's inevitable. And to be open, I've always struggled with mental health and things like that. Which is why for me, as such a passionate person, having a purpose, being purpose-driven, which is what led me to do this podcast, is so important. Purpose and passion propels me. That is just, I guess, the kind of like who I am fundamentally. And without that, I didn't know who I don't know who I am. And even through my ups and downs in life, I've always had a something that propelled me, some type of passion, some type of something, whether that was, you know, in high school to make it to college, or in college to finish an assignment, or to think of the career that lay ahead of me. And for the first time, I'm completely on my own. And like I mentioned, your early 20s, gosh, are a mess. No one warns you that. But for the first time, anything ahead of me was just completely uncharted. And without, you know, feeling purposeless, utterly purposeless and disinterested in everything, I kind of had no compass to chart that map and navigate my next steps. And it was odd because it literally felt like there was a flip that was just switched off where, you know, just like that, my obsession and love for environmentalism, for healing the planet, for which was my why, even though that's really broad, it was my why, it just turned off. And I had no interest in doing this podcast. I could not listen to the episodes because I've just felt like a different person than I was even a few months ago. And yeah, that was really hard and has been really, really hard. Because for the first time, I have literally questioned everything about myself, you know, who I am, what I'm interested in, what drives me, what are my skills, like, how am I going to pay the bills, how am I going to, like, where am I going to go, like, everything, and is it worth it even doing this, like, should I just stop, and, you know, I had to put out this episode eventually. It had been months since I recorded it. And so listening back to it for some reason was hard for me, I think because I just felt like all of the things that have happened the last few months have been so difficult that listening back to this felt like a weird, I don't know, I felt like a different person. I feel like a different person now almost. But when I was thinking about recording the intro, of course, I could just say like, hey, hello, welcome back, blah, blah, blah. But then I really felt like maybe I should just be honest and talk about what I've been going through and maybe it'll resonate with someone. So when I was thinking about what to say, and again, the biggest question lately has been, what is my why? And I have had no idea. And I've been trying to think of who am I? What do I love? What drives me? Why did I even start a podcast in the first place? Because part of me can't even remember. I mean, I know why, but I've been feeling so disconnected from that passion that I had a year ago. But I've been thinking and pacing back and forth around the house for the last couple of days because I needed to record this. And it struck me that the thread that connects all of the things that I've ever loved, or the things I'm passionate about, you know, I grew up as a dancer, I love art, I love books, I love podcasts and media and, you know, storytelling and all of that, the thread that connects all of these things is to make people feel. And I think that, I think that you can't change anyone's minds if you don't change their hearts. And if you don't change hearts, then you can't change the world. And even if you're having a conversation that is just like staunchly scientific or just a black and white environmentally driven conversation, it can still make someone feel something and change their perspective on this little thing, whether that's agriculture or fishing or clothing. And that's why I started this in the first place, was because once upon a time, some article or something made me feel a certain way. And then that kind of got the ball rolling. And I realized that talking about climate change and talking about all of these the different facets of environmentalism, I think, even though it might seem, you know, devoid of emotion or just strictly scientific, is an inherently emotional thing because it affects lives, the lives of people, the lives of animals, the lives of plants, the lives of future generations, which we talk about in the podcast episode. And that the beauty of a podcast is that you're telling stories. And I used to have a blog early in college that when I stopped doing it because I didn't feel like doing it anymore, and I kind of felt guilt about it. But like there was a project I started that I didn't finish, and therefore I accomplished nothing. And the funny thing is, even though it was so different than this podcast, the thread that connect those two things, that blog and this podcast, is my love of storytelling and the belief that everyone has a story to tell, and all of our stories kind of can be woven together into this huge web of like a common cause, which in the case of this podcast is sustainability and healing the earth and doing better and being better for future generations. And that has made me feel a little bit more purpose than I did just a few days ago. And that clicked, and I was like, how did I not see that? And I think that, yeah, I hope that one of these episodes, or even a different podcast, or a, you know, some sort of something somewhere, has made you feel something. And I hope it doesn't make you feel too much despair. I hope it makes you feel hope. And yeah, ironically, I just remembered that my closing question is always, what gives you hope for the future? And I think that these conversations and telling stories can evoke a sense of hope in people, and that sharing that message can then empower people to make a difference, as cliche as that sounds. So I didn't plan what to say in this introduction. I'm just literally talking to myself. will I re-record this? I don't know. But yeah, amidst my pacing back and forth around the house, that clicked. And I think over the last several months, my threads have felt completely chopped up and disjointed and disconnected, and I have just not known who I am or what I'm doing. And now that I think about it, all of this makes a little bit more sense, and life makes a little bit more sense, and my passion projects make a little bit more sense. And I don't know if any of that makes sense, but because I know that was terribly rambly, but yeah, storytelling. I hope that this podcast brings you joy and evokes emotion and makes you think and makes you feel and makes you question the world around you. And if it doesn't, or that's okay. But if there's ever anything else that you want to hear on this podcast, you can always message me. That was another thing too, was when I was questioning like whether or not to still continue this, I actually had not checked my statistics for months. But it was funny because on the Instagram, I only have like, I don't know, just under like 400 followers. So not a lot, but every day I get like a new follower, and it's never like a spam account. It's like a real person. And I continually got DMs, which I was like, wow, people are still finding this. Like, how wild is that? That someone across the world, or someone in a different state or a different country, someone somewhere with whom I've never spoken or don't know, stumbled across this little project of mine and is giving me a follow. And that's a really cool thing in the beauty of social media. And yeah. So anyways, the other day I went back, and because, like, you know, I kind of had to like force myself to edit this and record this intro, etc. And I looked at my statistics, and the last episode got like so many listens, and I don't know why. I don't know why. And I was like, oh, maybe that's a sign. But yeah, I hope this wasn't so random. I hope maybe someone somewhere out there, I hope this resonated. And I just wanted to be honest and open, because life is short. And I suppose if I'm talking about storytelling, then if this is my platform or podcast, then I should tell my story as well. So yeah, I hope that. So regarding the episode, I spoke with Pete Huff, who is the co-director at the Wallace Center, which is the center through/at which the Pastor Project is based. I discovered the Pastor Project through an online regenerative agriculture course that I was taking online. And the Pasture Project, according to their website, quote, works to advance regenerative grazing and grass-fed value chains in the upper Midwest as a scalable, market-driven solution for building healthy soil, viable farms, and resilient communities. They work with farmers, land managers, public agencies, and farm member-based organizations to build resources, provide technical assistance, and remove barriers for expanding the use of regenerative practices, value chains, and end markets that yield win-win outcomes for farmers, communities, and the environment. So the Pasture Project is so cool. They talked about regenerative grazing, which was something that I thought was really interesting. I always like to keep, the topics on the podcast really open. So, you know, I've talked to people who are advocating for veganism and talking about, you know, plant-based diets and such. But on the other hand, I also really wanted to talk about animals and livestock and the benefits of rotational grazing or regenerative grazing. So we talk all about that in the episode. Pete talks about the Pasture Project, the importance of incorporating animals and livestock into regenerative ecosystems. So yeah, it was such a great episode. Pete, I loved speaking to him. He spoke so eloquently and thoughtfully and passionately about the topic of regenerative agriculture. And I remember telling him at the time that we recorded this, so like back in spring, that everything he said I could have quoted and turned into a social media post, because everything he said was so just thought-provoking and thoughtful and just so eloquently said. So anyways, as per usual, I hope you enjoy the episode. And as per usual, all of the information about the Pasture Project and the Wallace Center will be linked in the show notes. So you can support them, you can follow them. And so without further ado, let's welcome Pete Huff to Seeking Sustainability. So yeah, if, just to start off, the first question I always ask everyone is, in your opinion, what does it mean to be an environmentalist?
That's a good question. Well, I think I've asked myself this question quite a few times, simply because I've been working on this pretty much, you know, before I was in college and then throughout my time in university and then onwards since. So I think it's changed over time. You know, I think when I think about what does it mean in a very broad, like philosophical, it's about having the perspective that it isn't about us, that it's about all of the things that make us possible, both past and present, all those relationships and opportunities that were given or were earned, and all of the like supporting, the supporting forces that are out there, the natural world, the people that are part of it. And I think it's also about that realization that it's about what we make possible for those that come after us. So I think being an environmentalist is about that appreciation and that multi-generational perspective, that is not a like an individual. It's about this deep web of relationships and this almost like incomprehensible genius of the natural world, of which we are part and we are supported by and contribute to. And I think just that appreciation about how little is accomplished by the individual and how important all of those relationships ultimately are, and kind of working to get together in these appreciative, mutualistic relationships between each other, within the natural world. And we just see that, you know, in the soil, in a diversified farm, in a good, healthy forest, in a neighborhood that's got a lot of a high quality of life, that's really the secret of success. So I think the environmentalist sees that it's about working together, and that we need that more and more in a really rapidly changing world. And it's funny because when I was getting, you know, your questions and thinking about this podcast, we're finishing up reading Braiding Sweetgrass.
I was just about to, ask you if you've read Braiding Sweetgrass. That's so funny that you say that.
It's a great book. Yeah, we're finishing up. We're reading that as a staff. Yeah, well, and I write in books. Fair warning, I'm sacrilegious in some folks' viewpoint. But I went back to find this particular one that Robin Wall Kimmerer mentioned it, and I think it answered the question, which is that action on behalf of life transforms because the relationship between self and the world is reciprocal. It's not a question of getting enlightened or saved and then acting. As we work to heal the earth heals us. And I just think that that really kind of answered the question for me in terms of environmentalist. It's that multi-generational perspective that it's not about us. It's about working together and appreciation for all the work and relationships and support that we receive. And that kind of really kind of brings into this like agroecological mindset, which we can talk a little bit about agroecology and kind of how that really flows through the work for me as an individual, but also is really infused in the Pasture Project's work. Even though it comes off as just cattle grazing, there's a deeper philosophy that sits behind it. And I think that's part of it.
Not gonna lie to you, Pete, that's my favorite answer that anyone's given on the podcast.
All right, gold star.
That is so funny you mentioned Brady Sweetgrass, because right when you started talking, I was like, oh, I wonder if he's read that. Because that book is like, it's like my Bible. It's so all-encompassing on for all of those things. Yeah, and the whole notion of reciprocity is so important. So yeah, if you would just be able to introduce yourself and talk about Pasture Project, what your role is, in Pasture Project and the work you guys do.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I'm Pete Huff. I'm the co-director of the Wallace Center, which is the home of the Pasture Project. It can be a little confusing sometimes about who we are and how we show up in the world. But the Wallace Center is the home for the Pasture Project and has been since its earliest ideation. So it's important to just maybe mention a little bit about the Pasture about the Wallace Center. You know, the Wallace Center's mission is really about bringing together diverse people and ideas that come with them to create solutions that are all about building healthy farms and equitable economies and resilient food systems. And we do that in the United States, but we exist within a larger organization that has a kind of a global range called Windrock International. And the Wallace as a whole has like a brand new strategic plan, which is a great opportunity where we all had to sit down as a team and really pause and say, like, what's the point of our mission? How do we actually bring it into the world to create a vision that we really stand behind? And we really break it down into two goals. The Wallace Center is all about, one, strengthening the change ecosystem, which for us means really investing in what we would call catalytic systems leadership. So thinking about how do those lead change, not just for the individual, but for the system. We also focus on that goal through equity and justice in farming and food systems. So I know you had a question we can get to around racial equity and justice. That's something is a lens through which the Wallace Center does its work, and the Pasture Project is part of that. And then the third objective that we use to get to strengthening the change ecosystem is really this idea of learning, collaboration, innovation, and action across communities, that the Wallace Center really kind of weaves networks together. That's a hard thing to say. And really brings communities together to learn together, because we very much have the mindset that communities know what they need. The system sometimes stops community from having access to the resources to accomplish their goals. Our second goal that the Wallace Center pursues, and this is where the Pasture Project sits, is about reimagining and redesigning our farming and food systems. And we kind of have two main ways that we think about doing that. One is regenerative land use, and Pasture Project is very much in that. The second is values-based supply chains, recognizing that we live in an economy, whether we agree with the way that economy works all the time and how it treats people is up for debate, but that we can preserve value in the process of connecting people to the land through supply chains. So that's a little bit about what we do at the Wallace Center. And we got a bunch of other information. I'd be happy to answer questions about all the stuff we do. The Pasture Project really came about, you know, 10, 12 years ago from this larger conversation of there's something wrong in the Gulf of Mexico. The dead zone is there. We're understanding it more and more. Where is that problem coming from, or where is that challenge coming from? Really literally moving upstream the Mississippi River to the headwaters. And once we got to the headwaters, the question was, how do we actually stop soil and nutrients from going into the Mississippi River? And the answer was a better use of land for agriculture than tilling for commodity, you know, corn and soy production. And the answer that came with that was you have to make it competitive to do something better for the land. And that was rotational grazing and grass-fed beef predominantly. Not because we're necessarily trying to put more burgers and steaks into the world, but the view was is that we need something that can convince people to move from what they're doing now to something that's better for the land, and not expecting them to do that at huge financial risk. And so we saw that pasture-raised livestock and grass-fed could be a way to build healthy soil. Healthy soil holds water, needs less nutrients, and it can make money on a level that's comparable with corn and soy. So so that's the Pasture Project, really is all about advancing what we would call regenerative grazing in the upper Midwest. And we really take that scalable approach, that systems change approach. We really think about it from a market-driven perspective, but we take it to an end goal of agroecological success, which is healthy soils, viable farms, resilient communities that really has that social justice, racial equity lens. So we kind of use the market to accomplish this larger suite of economic, environmental, and social beneficiaries. So we work with farmers, we work with land managers, government agencies, farm-based, you know, member-based organizations. And it's all about how do we expand the use of regenerative practices on farm that really is kind of a win-win-win outcome for farms and community and environment. And we do that as part of the Wallace Center. We can talk a lot about like all the different projects that we do, like it takes different forms in different states, but that's kind of like the encapsulation of kind of who the Wallace Center is and who the Pasture Project is within it.
That's so cool. It's so neat. I'm like really new to the regenerative agriculture space. So like anytime I get to have a conversation like this or hear someone talk about it, it's so neat. And that leads into regenerative grazing, because that is something I probably didn't know of until like a month or two ago. And then I'm reading Dirt to Soil by Gabe Brown right now. And he talks all about the importance of animal integration, which is really interesting because as someone who came from outside the agricultural space, there's kind of, I don't know if you'd call this like a mythology, but the conversation around like, you know, animals or cattle are bad for the environment and like, you know, all those notions around that. And then animal integration to me is kind of the opposite. It's saying like, no, here, look at the ways that we can use animals to help heal the soil. So can you talk about regenerative grazing and the importance of it and even just like what it is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So it's all about the soil. You know, at the end of the day, we wouldn't be here without it. That and the water, that is what we're made out of. Literally, it's our body transforms water and transforms the nutrients, the outcomes of the soil, whether it's in plant or animal form, into our very being and our very body. And so it's really, that's what it comes down to. Regenerative grazing is a means to improve the relationship between the soil, human beings, and plant communities. And kind of the water kind of flows through all of those things. And that, you know, it's really about this relationship between, you know, plant ecosystems and soil ecosystems that can be improved through rotational grazing of livestock. And we focus mostly on, you know, beef cattle, but, you know, there's regenerative grazing in a lot of different species. But animals really are part of ecosystems. They always have been, except for a few rare instances, but animals have always been part of the land. And really this idea of managing the land and managing the relationship between the animals, the plant community, the soil, the water, all of those forces, it's something that's been around for a very long time. Regenerative grazing is not new. It is a very, very long-standing tradition that really is about the relationship between the human being and the land, that sense of place. And again, going back to braiding sweetgrass, you know, whether it's, you know, the Potawatomi that Robin Kimmerer's from, or other, you know, groups that were around the Great Plains of the United States, a long-standing tradition of managing that with fire and working with natural herds to really manage that grassland ecology. So regenerative grazing is really about focusing on soil health and using the cattle in an adaptive observational way so that it's not about just like a prescription that puts animals on the land and takes them off. It's about being part of that relationship. It's about working with and observing the land and working with the cattle, working with the animals to ultimately help improve the health of that soil. So it looks different. And I think that that's the big challenge with regenerative overall. It's kind of the term du jour right now. And everyone's trying to define it. What does it mean? And it's a little bit difficult because it means a lot of different things in different places. And at the end of the day for me, and I think for the Pasture Project is it really improving the health of the soil? Because if it improves the health of the soil, then ultimately it probably improves the health of the farm. And by improving the health of the farm, it improves the health of the greater human and non-human ecosystem that is it's contained within. And so that's where we kind of see the end goal is really about improving that soil health. And it can work in different places in different ways. So we support it on perennial pasture, meaning continuous cover that's never tilled. It's, you know, your traditional pasture. It's also something that can be integrated in with, you know, cover crops on corn and soy farmland or other farmland. So there's a lot of manifestations and ways to bring animals back to the land. And that's something that we really push forward. The reality is, you know, you can kind of look at its place within the five principles of soil health. And if you haven't looked at that, it's really, you know, something that's worth exploring. And integrating livestock is one of the five principles for soil health, along with four others. And so we see that as kind of the key to regenerating the landscape, rebuilding soil health, and by doing so, rebuilding communities and farm economies. And there's a lot of like nitty gritties around like, what does that look like? And like, why regenerative grazing? But at the heart of it is like recognizing that it's about a relationship. It's about adapting to really meet the needs of the land and really build the health of the soil and making sure that you're very intentional and mindful about doing that. It's not prescriptive. It's not about, you know, following a formula. It's about a relationship. And I think that's also knowing when to graze and when to let land rest and really paying attention to more than just yourself in that process. Going back to that, what is an environmentalist? It's about, are we aware of the grass, you know, the grassland birds? Are we aware of the pollinator population? Are we aware of how saturated or not saturated the soil is? All of that goes into making decisions about how to reintegrate livestock into the land, when, for how long, and at what intensity, and when to move them on, much like a natural herding would move those animals on their own accord or through management. So I think that maybe that answered your question. I hope so. I mean, there's a lot of detail there about some of the benefits of regenerative grazing. There's also some science that's emerging in that space. But in essence, that's kind of the idea.
Yeah, it also kind of ties back to like what you were talking about at the beginning of like thinking ahead for future generations, preserving and regenerating the land for future generations. And I feel like that's what regenerative agriculture does, because if it's not just for like a let's fix it now kind of thing, I mean, because it does take time, but it's ensuring that future generations, our children, grandchildren have healthy soil.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. And I think, you know, we work closely with a lot of really great, smart people. And, you know, one of the points that's been made by one of them is that it's really hard for us to even know what healthy soil is, because it's yeah. been so degraded in so many places. And that, you know, we really are about reinvesting, you know, much like you kind of like that idea of like, you don't plant a tree for yourself. Right. You're really planting it for future generations. And I think with soil building through livestock, that's really, it is about kind of building that capacity over time. The nice thing is that it is also profitable for the current generation. You know, a lot of farms that we work with see a lot of benefit from integrating livestock back onto the land. That being said, it's not the perfect solution for everywhere. There are places where it makes sense and there's places where it doesn't make sense. And it has to be done mindfully and intentionally. Yeah. But there's a lot of benefit in terms of, you know, we talk to producers, farmers that are reintegrating livestock, and the things that they notice is the quality of life, that they love being out and working with the animals. It's something that really brings them joy, and that has value. They see the birds and the bird populations improving, and that has a lot of value. They notice how many bugs are just all over the place, the spiders and the grasshoppers and all of that. So there's already that appreciable value, as well as the fact that maybe they're putting less fertilizer down on their land, because they're reintroducing those nitrogen or that fertilizer, that nitrogen, the various different inputs through the natural system of the cow, and they're seeing a benefit there. And then a lot of them are also kind of plugging into, you know, different food systems, where they're moving food that they know is healthy, that they have a lot of pride in, that they've produced, into, you know, to communities that really need it. And, you know, there's this big debate out there. Every time you read the newspaper or look at the New York Times, it's like, if you're eating meat, you might as well be like setting off dirty bombs in your neighborhood. And it's like, that's really about thinking about livestock in the same way that we think about, any kind of, corn, soy, monoculture thinking, is that if you think about that, absolutely, cattle disconnected from the yeah. soil is a problem. Just like, growing, plants, corn, soy, whatever it may be, through heavy synthetic inputs is still disconnected really from the soil. It's not yeah. in relationship. So that's where a lot of it comes down to, at least for me, is it's recognizing that famous phrase, I always forget who said it, it's not the cow, it's the how. And that's absolutely true, is that it can be a force for positive change.
Yeah.
It's not mine. I'll have to Google it. Who said it. But I think that that's a good point, is it's like, it's beneficial for you now, but it's also creating more opportunities for the future generation and really paying it forward in a way, in respecting, what is, a teacher of mine, talked about this regenerative agriculture work, is we're on the cutting edge of a 10,000-year-old technology. Is that like, this is something that's respecting and honoring indigenous wisdom and yeah. current reality, that they're not gone. Those communities are still here and teaching us about how to be in right relationship with the land. And we owe that to pay it forward by leaving healthier soil, cleaner water, and stronger communities.
It kind of makes me think how, about 10,000-year-old technology, how, I don't know, did you see Elon Musk tweeted, like, I'll give like $100 million to anyone who figures out how to capture carbon?
I don't know if I saw. I was don't like, follow him. But
the plants?
yeah, absolutely. This really powerful force that shines every day, and this amazing ability to photosynthesize, and the complexity and the beauty of soil. I mean, it's really the new frontier of just how much life is in soil and how much life is lost through conventional approaches to agriculture. And part of that is breaking the cycle, breaking the relationships between the animal, the plant, and the soil. And that's what we try to solve with technology. But the reality is that we haven't gotten very good at like inventing artificial blades of grass. Like, we aren't smart enough yet to do that. And so why not rely on the things that co-evolve together and really reinstate the cycles and reinstate the relationships? And it could have vastly different outcomes on multiple levels. Part of it, I think it is about, it's about the breaking of relationship and also breaking the connection to place. You care for the things that you love, and the things that you love are the things that you feel support you. And how many of us feel supported by the land that we sit on? We don't have those relationships to the soil that produced the food, the plant or animal that was part of that, the hands, the labor, whether it's the farmer or the food chain worker, all of those that did that, we've lost that connection. And it's easy to not care about those things because they're not there in front of us, and we don't feel our dependence on them because we'll just get it from somewhere else.
That's so
and
true.
So I think breaking that, it created a sense of individualism that really still persists and is one of the biggest challenges. And that really, for us, a lot of it comes down to rebuilding community. So rebuilding community in the soil, in the plant community, in the farming community, in the growers and the eaters. And I think that that's really where there's been some fundamental disconnect. And I think going back to like thinking agroecologically, the reason that I like that kind of framework is because it also acknowledges that this is also about our political and our governance systems. It's about gender equity. It's about indigenous sovereignty and about all of these cultural things, that it is about all of these things working together. And so we also have a lot of healing to do there around political participation, around gender equity, about acknowledging structural racism and really finding meaningful, authentic ways to support anti-racism, multiculturalism. Because it is an agricultural act. Those things are agricultural by their nature because it's everything that sustains us and fits into it. So I really appreciate that. And I think that there's a lot moving in the world right now. And that's why for us as the Wallace Center, we take those things as part of our work. Like, we have to do racial justice work because, it absolutely, Pasture Project works in predominantly white communities and predominantly white audiences. And yet it's critical for us to be able to talk about this because it's part of the larger story of hurt and disenfranchisement. And it's also part of the larger story of healing and reinvesting in everyone's success and everyone's opportunities going forward.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, so can you talk a little bit for someone who might not be aware? Because I mean, that's something that I recently learned about the ways in which and obviously to not know about that, you have to really come from a place of white privilege. The how agriculture and racial inequity and injustice intersect, because the more I learn about agriculture, the more I learn about that. I attended a webinar with Leah Penniman from Soulfire Farm, mm-hmm. and she gave a whole lecture on that. And I was like mind blown at just the layers upon layers upon layers of policy and things put in place to hold Black people back from owning land, working on land, in a just way. So if you could just talk a little bit about that, and yeah.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I think similarly, I don't know a whole lot about it, being white, male, coming from a fairly well established, you know, secure background, going to college, things along those lines. Like there's certain things that like, I have my blind spots left, right, and center, not just racially, but also gender, class, socioeconomic, you know, but my, you know, my journey towards learning on this has been something that has, you know, grown over time. And I think it, you know, the Wallace Center has also been on a journey. And we just released this kind of document that kind of shows how we have come to really understand what does racial equity mean for farming and food systems, and what's our responsibility within that? Mm-hmm. And how do we own what we didn't do? And how do we commit to a journey of improvement going forward? And I'd be happy to forward you that journey document. It just came out, I think, earlier this month. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, the basis of agriculture in the United States is really based on stolen land and stolen labor. And that's something that is really hard to say, because we often lift up farming and agriculture as very noble professions and noble tasks, which they are. Feeding people is one of the highest forms of self-actualization, as far as I'm concerned. But the reality is that, you know, tribal nations were forcibly expelled from their traditional homelands, and some mm-hmm. remained, and many were forced off, and many died. And same thing as we all know, is the disenfranchisement, the stealing of labor from African communities, you know, is something that absolutely formed the foundation for the agricultural success of the United States. And those two combination, the combination of those two things, you know, we have to just be really honest about where we've come from. And we have to be able to acknowledge that intergenerational trauma is something that is real, and it affects all facets of our life.
Yeah.
In that there's still Black communities that, you know, haven't really even been settled that long, having left the South to flee Jim Crow, that are still trying to find their homes and find their communities and really build that wealth and success where they are, wherever that may be. And so, you know, for me, the intersection of agriculture and race is fundamental in that land and labor disenfranchisement, and also the generations of not acknowledging it, of not just saying what it is, of just yeah. like, that is the hard truth, and we have a journey towards healing that we need to get to. And we have to acknowledge that it's still present today. You know, the USDA, I just saw in President Biden's, you know, upcoming budget around establishing a much stronger presence within the USDA around racial equity and civil rights and justice, just because there is such a long history of discrimination within the USDA. And a lot of it is rooted in some of that very old thinking about who should get ahead in agriculture and who should get ahead in food. And the history and the ongoing reality of Black land loss is absolutely an epidemic, and it's something that has to be acknowledged, because it's something that is too often ignored, and that, you know, the Black community has generation by generation lost farmland that it really worked hard to build. So I think that there's a need there to tell the truth, to acknowledge the history, to recognize that racial equity is not something that people of color have a responsibility to help people out, white people out with. In fact, it's an opportunity for us to educate ourselves and to really step up to support the kind of policies, the kind of practices, the kind of opportunities that help all people feel welcome in communities, in farming communities, so that they can feel successful and they can feed themselves, they can feed their community, and they can participate in this larger experiment that is our country and is the human race. And I think that there is just a lot of work to be done on that. We're working on that just internally right now, is who feels welcome in the farming community? And how do we encourage diversity within the farming community when it may be predominantly white and it may be predominantly male? And how do we, as someone like the Pasture Project, think about even just basic diversity and representation of like, how do we make sure that we're not just framing it from a white centric, you know, perspective in our language, in terms of the imagery, in terms of the examples that we might do. We really try to build a racial equity lens into everything that the Pasture Project does, that the Wallace Center does, in a very operational and explicit way, meaning it's not just something we say, it's something that we can accountably demonstrate that we're doing, from everything from how we find money to do our work, to how we hire new staff, to how we hire new contractors to help us with our projects, to how we even choose, you know, how we step into a community in order to respect the inherent leadership that's there, because we don't want to be part of that problem. We want to acknowledge our history and really move forward in a more equitable, inclusive, and just way.
That's awesome. And I think even like something that I learned is even being on the land is traumatizing for some people. One of like an aha moment for me. So I did woofing. So like where you volunteer for, and I went for like a month and I was trying to convince one of my friends to do it, who's Black. And she was like, I don't think I feel okay working for free on a farm. And I was like, oh, and she was like, yeah. And so that was a kind of wake up moment for me where I was like, it's a privilege that I even feel okay, you know, going on to work on a farm for free. And so, I mean, yeah, there's so many layers to it. But that's incredible that you guys are doing the work. And that gives me so much hope for the agricultural space. And it makes me really excited to kind of start to be a part of this world when there's amazing people like you guys doing this kind of work.
I encourage that. And I think the thing that we always try to remember is that we're on the shoulders of people that have been doing this incredible work for a really long time. And I think that is reflected in, you know, across the board in terms of, you know, farmers of color, farmer advocates of color, you know, whether it's, you know, within the Black community, within the Indigenous community, or within the Asian American community, whatever it may be, you know, there's been for generations, like the civil rights movement has an incredible history that was really built on, to a large degree, you know, support and relationship from farmers in the South, Black farmers in the South, is that they're present in the movement for civil rights. They're present now. And I think building on that is really important. And it's an opportunity first and foremost for all of us to really listen and to learn and to just always work towards creating new opportunities. And for us, you know, a big metric there is, you know, real wealth creation, not just leasing land, not just, you know, giving away labor or working a job, but actually how do we see this result in ownership of land and ownership of value chain businesses and real sovereignty and self-determination within communities, is that it is about being able to feel fully free and fully empowered in a healthy sense. And that really comes from ownership of those things. And so that's something that we see on the horizon of where things we really need to go is building wealth across generations and building ownership in that.
Closing question is, as an individual, an environmentalist, and also someone working in the agricultural space, what gives you hope for the future?
Hope for the future. Well, I think it's that, I think what gives me hope for the future are the moments that I have, in which you see that at the heart of most people is a desire for community and connection, and that people really have phenomenally good ideas, regardless of what their background or pedigree or anything. You know, they don't need a PhD to be an expert. I have met some of the most brilliant people I've ever met, you know, are folks that have never gone to college or maybe didn't finish high school. And they really have a deep relationship to place and a deep relationship to land and to those around them, both human and non-human. And they really are acting from that place of, you know, that responsibility and that relationship. It takes us back to the top of the conversation about what does it mean to be an environmentalist. And I think that those folks give me give me hope, because they really come up with brilliant ideas, and they are really doing it to invest in that future generation. And that is something that's really powerful. And I've seen that happen in a lot of different places. You know, through the Pasture Project, we work with a lot of different perspectives, and we don't turn anybody away. Our view is, if you want to work with us and you want to work towards a better vision for agriculture, we want to work with you. And so that means that we do work with folks that are, you know, corn and soy producers in the most conventional senses. And we see that there's a human being there that's responding to the system, and they're looking for a way to do better and to be part of a community and to be responsible stewards and to pass something forward of value, whether it's to their children or their community or just the general natural world or human world. So I see that all the time in folks, and it comes from the most unlikely places, whether it's a traditional corn and soy farmer in Illinois that really is trying something new. They're putting cattle on cover crops, and they're the talk of the town, and everyone thinks that they're crazy, but they're doing it because they really see the benefit and they see the value for themselves, but also more broadly. Or it might be someone who works for a public agency that really is, you know, trying something different around, you know, protecting and supporting public lands and how they can find creative solutions to, you know, both bring birds back to the land, but also create opportunities for farmers. And then also just seeing it in all of the other, you know, folks that are working around these solutions. I am very fortunate to be able to talk with incredible people that are really, you know, thinking outside the box, and they're really coming at it from a human-centered approach where it's about connection, it's about community, it's about creating that better tomorrow for all people. I think the world is full of a lot of media that makes us sometimes feel like it's not there. But I think at the end of the day, you know, people ultimately do want to help each other and be part of that, a healthy natural world. So that brings me a lot of hope and the courage that folks demonstrate in really stepping forward to lead that, whether it's on their farm or in their community or in their business. I think that that's something to be celebrated. And for us at the Pasture Project and myself, we just seek to lift up and support that. That is really, it's not about us. It's about recognizing the immense potential and the immense genius of the natural world and the human's relationship with it. How can we make sure that we really lift that up, celebrate it, and give people as many options as possible to come together?
Thank you again, everyone, for tuning into this episode of Seeking Sustainability. If you enjoyed this episode or any others that you've listened to, then make sure to follow the podcast on whatever platform you're tuning in from. Also, to stay connected, you can follow the podcast Instagram at seekingsustainability_podcast and my personal Instagram at julia.planford. As always, feel free to reach out to me regarding any questions, comments, or episode requests. And of course, share this podcast with anyone who you feel might be interested in learning a bit more about environmentalism and sustainability as well. Thanks, everyone, and I will talk to you guys soon.